explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe, of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are and why we are here and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in this series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome to X Squared Radio, Earth Explorers. This is Brooks Agnew coming to you from Western Kentucky. July 30th, 2006. According to my AccuWindow forecast, it's about 96 degrees still here in Western Kentucky. Sunspots 901 and 902 are facing Earth, but they are too small to affect us. About 4 days later than expected, the solar wind hit Earth on the 27th of July and caused a marvelous aurora borealis as far south as Washington and Wisconsin. Also in space news, scientists believe it is raining on Titan, Saturn's moon, where the Huyen probe landed last year. The only difference is that the rain is made of methane. Can you imagine what the rainbows look like? The solar wind is a moderate 391.6 kilometers per second right now. There is a solar wind streaming from a coronal hole and should reach us tomorrow. There is a chance for a geomagnetic storm and further auroral activity. We here at X Squared Radio want you to do three things for us. We have committed to bringing you all of our content for free. You can listen for free to the live broadcast, the archives, and even the podcasted archives. All we ask is that you do the following. When you get ready to buy inkjet cartridges, historical replicas, or other neat stuff for your space, please shop the affiliates at X Squared Radio. The prices are amazingly low, and in most cases you get free shipping. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter and send us the call letters of your AM radio station. If you'll do those things, we'll make sure our sponsors and affiliates pay to bring you this program at their expense. Next week on X Squared Radio, we have Kevin and Matthew Taylor coming on the program. They will be discussing their amazing book, The Land of No Horizon. If you think you understand the Hollow Earth theory, you don't. This book is one of the best ever written on the subject. I highly recommend it. But I recommend that you be here next week at 6 p.m. to listen to this interview. It will amaze you and change everything you ever thought about the creation and destiny of the Earth. If you want to stay current on our programs, guests, books, CDs, DVDs, and other outstanding stuff for your space, you can make X Squared Radio your favorite place on the web just by going to x2-radio.com and add it to your favorites. We want to welcome our AM affiliates and your many requests that this program be placed onto XM or Sirius. I believe that everything we do eventually affects the universe. So, and your effects are having their effect, and I appreciate it. Tonight, our guest is the widely published John Lash. He is a comparative mythologist who specializes in stellar lore. He has spent more than 30 years in research and experimentation using both signs and constellations. His books, Quest for the Zodiac and Not in His Image, are of particular interest to me. He believes the Starchild cycle provides a method for detecting genius, the endowment of each individual from the evolutional wisdom of the human species. I want to make you aware that this is another global first here tonight on X Squared Radio. You think you know astrology? Well, you are about to discover some things about it that will stun you. This is the first time this subject has been discussed in public. Ever. You're going to get it first, right here. We may discover the destiny of the human race tonight, so please welcome with me the very eloquent and knowledgeable John Lash. How are you tonight?
I'm fine, Brooks.
Excellent. John is joining us from Belgium. He sounds like he's right next door.
Well, I feel like I'm very close. Thanks for this invitation, and that's a fabulous intro, and it's all true.
Well, I appreciate it. I try to do my homework and try to make up my own stuff, and I think that's why people come to X Squared Radio. They listen to entertainers on the other radio stations, and then they come here to find out the information and to grow and to learn. Well, I've been exposed to astrology most of my life. My mother and grandmother kind of dabbled in it, although they never really explained anything to me, not like they could. I think most people are amazed by it. But if you have been able to, you've been able to figure things out that I think astrologers have forgotten. You have figured out how to explain the destiny of mankind without demanding that we are each locked into a course of events from which we cannot deviate, even if we try. I think you figured out that modern astrology ignores the stars. Now, I know that our listeners are going to find this shocking, but the science you present is absolutely fascinating, and I want to explore it. First of all, can you tell us what star zodiac is?
Well, you know, it's extremely easy and extremely simple, and this is the first occasion that I've had publicly to talk about the star zodiac and what it really is, and it continues to amaze me after all these years that that other people aren't talking about it and that other people haven't come forward and made this very simple distinction that I'm making in Quest for the Zodiac. as you know, because you've just read the book, it is a very simple distinction. It is a very simple sentence to say that astrology ignores the stars. That's not an interpretation. It's a fact, which I will explain in a moment. But once that simple statement is made, the implications are truly tremendous.
Oh, they sure are.
Basically, I mean, what that means is that the kind of astrology that most of us are familiar with is technically called tropical astrology, and it uses a model of signs, which everyone knows. Even people who don't believe in astrology and don't follow it probably know what their sun sign is. It's absolutely universal, this framework. And in this sign framework, astrologers work, and they have various methods of reading human character. It can be a very good tool for analyzing and profiling human character. And I want to make it clear to the listeners that I am in no way putting down the system or saying that it's invalid. I've used it myself. I have practiced for many years. I don't anymore. But I practiced as an astrologer, and people would come to me, and I would profile them psychologically, and I would discuss with them their complexes and their issues, which I would find elucidated by using the tool of the horoscope. However, from the very beginning of my involvement with astrology, which was when I was about 19 or 20 years old, and I started to get into it, I was baffled by the fact that this model, the sign, zodiacal signs, has actually nothing to do with the real patterns of stars in the sky.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah.
How does the sign-based astrology differ from the star-based astrology?
Well, the sign-based astrology is a format. It's a system that was actually invented or codified around 150 A.D. by a Greek astronomer and astrologer named Ptolemy. And to understand the system, you don't really have to have a great deep grasp of astronomy. You just have to understand the four seasons, as everyone does. Everyone knows that that there are, the year is divided into four quarters. The moment of spring is the spring equinox. Then we have the summer solstice. That's when the sun is highest in the sky. Then we have the fall equinox and the winter solstice. And this quarter system is essentially nothing but a division of the orbit of the Earth. If you imagine the orbit of the Earth, put the sun in the center and have the Earth going around the sun, and then just divide it into four quarters as if you were cutting up a pie. Those are the four seasons. Then if you further subdivide it into three sections each, you get the 12 signs of the zodiac. That model, which is called the seasonal or tropical model, is an abstract model that has, in which the positions of the planets have no reference to the actual stars. They're only referred to the model itself.
Hmm. Now, these four points, are these the cardinal points like are outlined on the Mayan calendar?
They're the solstices and the equinoxes that are observed in most of the sacred calendars in one way or another.
Ah, okay.
All right. But the important thing about the sign zodiac, as I'm calling it, and this is the one that everyone is familiar with. For instance, if you're born in the first 30 days after the spring equinox, which happens on March 21st, during those 30 days, the sun is in the section of that model, the slice of that model, called Aries. So it would say, well, you are born and you belong to the sign Aries. That's your sun sign, and then the astrologer would proceed to, you know, profile you and analyze your behavior based on that. Now, I'm saying, as you know, because you've read my book, I'm not saying that's incorrect. I know that's correct, and I know it works because I've used it myself. The astonishing thing is that that system has nothing to do with the actual constellations in the sky.
Really?
Nothing at all. To say that you are an Aries, if you're born in the first 30 days after March 21st, says nothing about where the sun was actually in the visible star patterns. In fact, during those 30 days, the sun is not in the constellation of Aries. It's in another pattern.
Wow.
So there are two zodiacs. There's the sign zodiac, which everyone knows, and most people, many, many people who will be listening now will have had their horoscope done. And I'm not going to try to say that their horoscope is invalid in terms of that system, in terms of the definition of it, its own parameters. It's quite valid, but they're missing something. There is a second zodiac, which I call the star zodiac or stellar zodiac. And you have, each one of us has another horoscope in that other framework.
That they don't even know about.
That they don't even know about. And what is really amazing about this particular dilemma, if you want to call it that, is that when I started astrology, because I was interested in astronomy, really, and that's why it came to my attention. Oh, wait a minute, I read a few astrology books, and I thought, these people aren't talking about the sky at all. One of the analogies that I give that I think is helpful to people to understand this, Brooks, and you saw it in my book, is like the world time zones. We all know that the world is divided into 24 time zones.
Yeah.
And if I fly from London to New York, I fly across 6 time zones. But when I'm looking down from the airplane, I don't see those time zones, do I?
No, you don't.
Because they're just an abstract model. What I see is continents and oceans and islands. So there are the sign zodiac is like the model of the time zones. But the star zodiac is like the actual territory that you see in the sky. So when I discovered that there was a difference between those two, I was very perplexed, and I continued to work with sign astrology, the conventional form, but I developed a passionate need to understand what the actual patterns of the stars in the sky could mean. And most astrologers completely ignore this.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, it's
word,
absolutely baffling.
You mentioned the word horoscope a minute ago. Now, when most people think of a horoscope, they don't really think of it in its Greek terms. What does the term horoscope mean? Where did it come from?
Well, it comes from Greek. It literally means to watch or observe the hour. And it is a photograph of where the planets, the sun, the moon, and the planets, are positioned at the hour of a person's birth. But the whole key to that sentence that I just said is where they are positioned. The horoscope does not show where they are positioned in the visible patterns of the sky. It shows where they are positioned in this sun sign model.
Well, I know if I travel a lot too and pick up newspapers and magazines, and I always wonder this horoscopic observation is made by whom? I mean, when I pick up a newspaper or a monthly magazine and there's some little blurb about what I, as a Gemini, am supposed to expect, I don't really put much faith in it. I mean, do you?
No, I don't. There's a lot of bullshit in astrology, and there's a lot of con. And I have to tell you, having practiced it for many years, there's no better guarantee of success with a person than telling them that you're going to sit there for 2 hours and talk to them about themselves, because they'll listen to pretty much whatever you say. You know,
I always thought knowing a little bit about the signs was a great way to pick people up in a bar. That's the only thing I really knew about. But
it is indeed, and it has functioned for many years in that way. But on the serious side, there are some good astrologers around. It's not easy to be a good astrologer. It's a very difficult discipline. It's a complex art. But a good astrologer is someone who will sit down with you, knowing almost nothing about you, and with your horoscope in front of them. I'm not talking now about the star zodiac, because we're going to go to that later. I'm just talking about the sign zodiac. They will tell you about your personality, about your behavior, about the major complexes in your life, and they will present you an accurate psychological profile, you know. But they will not predict. Genuine astrologers are psychologists, not fortune tellers. Prediction and a lot of the other kind of stereotyped blah, blah, blah that goes on around astrology is unfortunately a lot of disinformation. But there is a genuine science there, and it does work. I am not invalidating it.
I have known one. I was admittedly quite young when I met him, and he used a lot of mathematics and geometry and where the person was born, on the earth, at what time.
Oh, yes.
And he went into a lot of detail, and I understand that he helped people. He really did a good service. And I think, you know, when I talk about Earth observers, ancient or modern, looking out into the night sky, you know, how do they really see the constellations? I mean, I've been in the mountains, I've been out on the ocean, I've looked up, I can barely find the planets. I'm an amateur astronomer, but I don't really know where Sagittarius is or Aries is or Taurus is. I don't think I could find it by looking up at the sky. So,
well, I wish I was in Kentucky this evening, because I have a way in which I can show you in 20 minutes how to find the entire zodiac and how to follow it through the year. It's extremely simple.
That's cool.
Yeah, people are intimidated, I think, in our time by the experience of going out and looking at the sky. And I think the reason for that is because most of us have been born or grown up in urban civilizations, in big cities where we don't see the sky very much. And it seems like an alien and remote environment. Mm-hmm. And when we do get a chance to be out in the wilderness in a natural park or somewhere and we see it, it's so overwhelmingly vast that we feel intimidated. But I want to assure you that knowledge of the sky and the ability to relate to the sky is innate to the human psyche.
Wow.
It's part of our heritage. And it is not that difficult to recover those skills. It's quite easy to learn how to observe these visible constellations. You just go out and you look at them. They're there. You can't see a sign. You can't see the sign Aries. You can't see the sign Cancer. But you can see the star pattern of the ram, which is not the same, and you can see the star pattern of the crab. You can see these 13 principal star patterns, and it's quite easy to orient yourself to them, believe me. No reason to be intimidated about that at all.
I'll have to take a class. Someone will take me out and show me. And I know that the star zodiac is quite stable in the heavens. It's just Earth's axis that moves through them like a procession, right?
Right. The actual patterns of the star zodiac, there are 13 of them, and they are uneven. And so they're quite different from the 12 divisions of the sign zodiac, which are all 30 degrees each. I call it the pizza slice zodiac.
Hmm.
When you go out and you actually look at the constellations of the zodiac, you'll see that they are all of quite different sizes. But they are very stable in terms of their visual recognition pattern. They don't change except over 100, 150, or 2,000 years. They kind of distort slightly. Mm. But when we look at them today, we're seeing basically what our ancestors have seen way, way back to 80 or 100,000 years ago.
Well, I mean, that's a good observation. You talk about pie slices of a circle. And in your book, you mention what I think I've heard this term before. What is the circle of animals, and how in the world did the ancient man come up with it? When I look up, you know, I might be able to find Cassiopeia, or I might be able to find Orion's Belt, but I can't figure out how they came up with this, with the animals that they came up with.
Yes, well, I analyzed that Greek word, as you know. Zodiacos kaikilos, and it's usually translated as the circle or belt of animals.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that translation is not correct, because in fact, if you look at the star zodiac, now I'm talking about the visible one, you can see, you'll see that it consists of 13 figures, and not many of them are animals.
Yeah, they're not all animals.
No, there is a woman, a large woman, a goddess-type figure, the Virgin. There is a yogi or shaman figure called the snake tamer. There is a scorpion, which is an insect rather than an animal. There's another human figure called the water bearer or the Aquarius. There are fishes. Well, the animals are a bull, a ram, that is a goat or lamb, and that's about it. And then there's a diversity of creatures, and then there's also a man-made object, the scales or balance. So it puzzled me for a long time. Well, the ancients were not stupid. Why would they call the zodiac a circle of animals if it only has two or three animals in it?
That's a good question.
Right. And my conclusion is that we have not translated that correctly, that it should not be called a circle of animals. It should be called a circle of animations.
I know it's quite important to ancient man. You say it goes back about 80,000 years. One structure that I can recall is the temple Dendera. It was quite important to the ancients. Even the word temple comes from the Latin meaning time site.
That's right.
So, you know, they used it not just to mark time, but they also discovered some patterns about it in human behavior and human psyche that exist even today.
Precisely. The ancients believed, or I would rather say that they experienced, these great star patterns in the sky.
Hello?
Like the star pattern of
excuse me.
I hate to break in.
Do we have a caller?
No, I was just going to say, it's hard to hear you. You're very light, but your guest is, you know, has the opposite. So it's hard to balance it.
Well, let me see if I can. I'll raise my volume just a little bit. How's that?
That would be great.
Is that a little bit better?
Well, I can't hear much of a difference, but the best. I guess try the best you can.
I know on my sound meters, we're virtually matched.
Good. Well, I'll try to keep the mouthpiece a little off to the side here.
Oh, that'll work. Thank you.
That'll work fine.
Good.
Sorry about that. Well,
so we were saying the ancients just didn't observe these patterns to them, the constellations, which I'm distinguishing from the signs. I hope that distinction is coming across here.
Yeah.
Of course, one of the handicaps of our conversation, Brooks, is that we can't project a model here and show the listeners visually what we're talking about. But I think the distinction is getting across anyway.
Well, I know you set out to solve this code of the zodiac, and I want to quote you from your book. This is really good quest for the zodiac on the following. I advanced by slow, awkward steps, dimly aware that another kind of language was emerging from the astrological format. The code was to reveal itself ever so slowly through a sort of poetic paraphrase of the hard data. As long as the zodiac star formations are not drawn as images, they remain pure astronomical data. Rendered as images, they become a mythological display. Now, you mentioned that while you were trying to absorb this raw data directly from the stars, all you had to do was blink and the picture became clear. Can you tell us about that experience?
Well, that's quite a question. And I did say all I had to do was blink.
I know if you go out and you stare at the stars and don't move your eyes, certain portions of them become invisible to you. And as you move your eyes again, then the more faint stars become aware, you become aware of them again. It's more like the rods and cones in your eye are becoming habituated to the really pale light.
That's right.
But I never thought about blinking. I think that's an amazing observation.
Well, blinking does help, and I meant in that when I wrote that paragraph, I meant blinking at two levels. I meant, yes, blinking at the stars as you're looking at them, at these patterns, can be a very helpful device for receiving the subliminal images that are there. But I also meant more that I was blinking at kind of an imaginative level. I think that the best way we can convey to the listeners here, because we don't have a graphic model to offer them, there are plenty of graphic models in the book, but here on the radio medium we don't have that, is for me to demonstrate exactly what I experienced in discovering the star zodiac.
Yeah.
And I'll use myself for an example, and then we can use you for an example. How about that?
Okay.
So I'm a Sagittarius, okay? So I learned very, very early on how to calculate my chart. And if you calculate, I was born on December 3rd. And so the sun in the system of signs is in the 11th degree of Sagittarius. Now, that is data. That is just pure astronomical data. There's nothing symbolic about that. That is where it is located. And so the astrologer, working with the sign system, then interprets my character based on the traits of Sagittarius and so forth, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But at the same time that I was using the sign model, I also knew that beyond it, there was the star zodiac, and that the sun, at the moment of my birth, the day of my birth, was in that star zodiac somewhere. Where is it in the actual star zodiac? So I created a circular model of the star zodiac, and I put it around the rim of the signs so that whenever I did a chart, I could see where the planets were in the star zodiac. Now, in my case, for instance, or in the case of anyone who's born early in December, the sun is in the sign Sagittarius, yes, but in the star zodiac, it's in the body, the upper body of the Scorpion, which is a huge glittering constellation, shaped like a scorpion, actually. So the Scorpion is one of the few constellations of the star zodiac that actually resembles what it's supposed to be. You really see a huge torso of a scorpion with his curving tail and his claws. And if you're born in the beginning of December, the sun is located in the upper body, or the upper torso of the scorpion. Now, what does this mean? Well, at the time that I started to work in astrology, there were many, many books that could tell me what it means to be a Sagittarius, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But there was no book that could tell me what it means to have the sun in the upper body of the scorpion.
I see.
Because no astrology books, even the ones that claim to work with the stars, actually work with these visible star patterns. And so my discovery, which I've tried to convey in Quest for the Zodiac, was an astonishing recovery of something that is right there before our eyes all the time, but has been forgotten for almost 2,000 years.
Right. There's more information.
Enormous amount of information. Enormous. And the whole process that I went through in Quest for the Zodiac was how to translate and decode that information. Because, as I said, everyone has a horoscope, and that's valid for your personality. But the positions of the planets in the star zodiac carry another kind of information about who you are and what you have inside you, what your human potential is.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I've been fascinated reading your book, and I want to see if I can capture the zeal and dedication you had for this work of yours. Allow me to quote your book again. It says, "Later on, my fascination with the stars continued under other climes. After leaving home at 16, I spent 3 years wandering around the world, more or less penniless, as one could always do in ancient days. Drifting through 30 countries, I watched the skies from mountain crags in the Himalayas and from the deck of a tramp steamer cruising through the Straits of Malacca near the equator. One night on the Indian Ocean, there was nothing but a black sea all around and another black sea above. The surface of the water was a perfect mirror of obsidian. During a moment, I could not tell if my Liberian rust bucket was gliding through the sea or through the sky. Now, how was it that the code revealed itself to you in these amazing experiences?"
Well, I will thank you for reading that passage. I will emphasize that the difference between the star zodiac and the sign zodiac is a difference in participation. Normally, if you're an ordinary person, once your horoscope done, you go to the astrologer, and the astrologer feeds you information. The astrologer is a technical expert on the information in the horoscope, and you don't really have to do anything except sit there and listen to that information and take it in. With the star zodiac, you must participate in the wonder of those vast starry constellations. You must interact with them, which is what I did over a great many years when I was traveling, and after that when I lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where there was wonderful sky viewing conditions.
Oh yeah, there's nothing like the West. Where there's
up there in the Rocky Mountains at 7,000 feet. I would be out every night wandering in the Llanos and looking at the sky and watching the stars. And so one of the most important first things that we need to understand about the star zodiac is that it's out there. You can see it with your naked eye. And it changes through the course of the year. Different constellations become visible at different times. But it is a constant phenomenon. And I believe, I'm certain, in fact, that I was eventually able to crack the zodiac code because I had spent many, many years at night observing the stars, observing the patterns, and living with them, taking them in, assimilating them.
Well, it's kind of like you say in your book, you step out on the front porch and you look across your yard to your perimeter fence, which may be 100 or 200 feet away. Looking at the stars is like looking at something 5,000 miles away.
That's right. That's right, it is. When you see the planets, and you come to recognize the planets because they look like stars, but they move through these patterns. The patterns don't move.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go out and observe over several months, you will see that there are certain star-like bodies moving through the planets. Planet simply means wanderer.
Wow.
And one of the fantastic things that you learn is that as you're standing there on your patio, you're looking up, for instance, at perhaps the planet Jupiter, which can be seen very clearly right now. It's in the constellation of the scales. Jupiter itself is like on the perimeter fence of your property. Maybe it's 100, 200 feet away.
Right.
But the stars in the background of Jupiter are 5,000 miles away. So there's a vastness that you enter into, and I believe that not only does the star zodiac contain vital information about human survival and about our spiritual and creative potential, but it reconnects us to the depth dimension of the cosmos.
Oh yeah, we're gonna talk a lot about that in our second hour. I want to ask, how did the, you mentioned this amazing analogy in your book and how you came to it, and I'll let you go into the details, but how did the zodiac appear to be like the human brain to you?
Well, upon the experience that I accumulated of many, many years of watching the sky at night, particularly in Santa Fe, and I used to give sky watching tours, but most often I was out there by myself with the coyotes. It's hard to describe this because it's something that comes intuitively. I suppose you could compare it to sailing on the ocean. If you spent a lot of time sailing on the ocean in a sailboat, you eventually begin to feel that you are permeated by the elements of the ocean, the salt, the air, the wind. Well, something similar happens when you observe the night sky. Over a period of time, there's a sensation that you are permeated, that your very brain is being imprinted by these images. And I'm sure that that's the experience that our ancestors had before there were cities, before there were great urban civilizations, and before there was man-made lighting that made it difficult to observe the sky. So by going into that experience, we're actually recapturing something quite primordial.
Well, I know with the addition of modern computers to the management of the data, the charts and the lore of the actual signs, and you know, what new experiences have you had in deciphering the code of the zodiac since the addition of the computer?
Very little. I don't rely on SkyGlobe. And back in the around 1998, 1999, and 2000, when I was writing Quest for the Zodiac, I had occasion to be working with some people in England and in Europe, Graham Hancock, Robert Vauvall, people like that, were doing some very fascinating work in the retrieval of ancient astronomy and the and rediscovering the astronomy of the pyramids and Stonehenge and so forth. And they were all relying very heavily on SkyGlobe. I think SkyGlobe is a wonderful tool, and everyone doing the kind of work we're talking about should have SkyGlobe, by which you can go on your computer and look at the constellations, see where the planets were. You can even simulate precession. But it's no substitute for being out there under the night sky and learning how the sky works
through
the seasons.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
I was going to ask a question about the, you know, once you decided that you're doing all this manually and you're not really relying on SkyGlobe, which is a piece of software. One of the things that I noticed, and I really picked up in your book heavily, was the fact that, you know, we talk about how star constellations might affect us, or how certain planets in certain houses or risings, and I don't really understand all the terms in detail, but it seems that Earth is left out of the equation.
Yeah, interesting detail, interesting omission, huh?
I mean, I would think if you're going to talk about planets that affect, you know, human beings, we're talking about everything except, you know, the moon and the Earth.
Yes, I know. It's really absurd. And one of the first things that I did when I became professional, because I worked for about 3 to 5 years before I tried to do any professional readings, as soon as I went professional, that was in the 70s, I added the Earth to the horoscope because I thought that it was absolutely absurd that we should talk about planets and leave out the Earth, the planet that we happen to be living on.
Now, that's revolutionary. So what effect did it have?
Well, it doesn't really have an effect. One of the things that I would like to make clear, if I can, and this, again, is a difficult point for perhaps for people to understand. I have to tell you, it's a difficult point for many astrologers to understand. It's very common to speak of the effect of the planets, Mars, the Moon, Saturn, on human behavior. I personally was never an astrologer who adopted that principle. I do not believe in the effect of the planets on us, behaviorally speaking. I believe that there is an effect physiologically, and obviously because we are physical beings and we are involved in the whole physical planetary system. But I do not believe in an effect in a fatalistic sense, that the planets make us do anything.
Oh, you mean relative to destiny?
That's right. We are the architects of our own destiny. The planets do not create our destiny. And through many years, I struggled with this concept because, of course, if you say you're an astrologer, most people will assume that you believe in the effect in the effect of the planets on human beings. So I had a real problem with that. And I had to struggle to reformulate it in a way that was acceptable to me, you understand?
Mm-hmm.
And I reformulated it in a very simple way. I said that in my understanding, the planets, the patterns of the planets, and this applies as well to the starry patterns, do not affect us. They are more a mirroring of what we are doing. They mirror rather than affect.
They're sort of like a record.
They are a record, as you well know from reading my book. The constellations record the many, many millennia of human experience, and they show how we are positioned on the learning curve of the human species. And all of that is about learning, evolving, creating, tapping into human potential, and none of it has to do with predestination or a fatalistic idea of planetary effects. I totally reject that.
That's so refreshing to know. And I look back and you see, you know, much of history of the early world. I mean, they're just steeped in the zodiac, or in our interaction with mythical beings from it. One of the things I noticed in your book, and you write about it a lot, and it happens to tie into things that some of my other guests have spoken about, and I want to get your perspective. Who was Enki, and how did he end up in the constellation?
Well, that's a huge question. In fact, it's one of the unresolved questions of the zodiac. In these 13 constellational figures, we have archetypes, if you will, divine beings, if you will, who have been part of human imagination since the human species came on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have their own particular histories. Like, as you know, there's Ophiuchus, or the snake tamer, which is the 13th constellation, which has been entirely left out of sun sign astrology. And that is obviously a shamanic figure. It's a man wrestling with a serpent. So we think of Kundalini. We think of the old Asian tradition of the shaman and the mystic.
Mm-hmm.
Enki is another powerful male figure, the other powerful male figure in the zodiac. And I identify Enki with the water bearer, or the constellation of Aquarius.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because very, very old Babylonian images of Enki associate him with water and show him with the urn of water or with streams of water coming off his body. And if you were to ask me to, in a sentence, to define or identify this character Enki as a zodiacal figure, I would say that he represents a kind of spiritual guardian of the human race, so an overseer of human evolution.
Wow.
And if you go back to the Sumerian material and you read about Enki or Ea, Enki means Lord of the Earth in Sumerian, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that definition, an overseer of human evolution, is consistent with the ancient Sumerian lore that we have on Enki.
And how did he end up in the zodiac? I mean, was it just because it could have been virtually any human form? Why did they pick Enki to put into the constellation that way?
Well, the constellations of the zodiac seem to have been designed of course, the star patterns themselves weren't designed. They were just there. They're part of the structure of the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
But the images associated with them and the meanings of these images seem to have been designed by ancient seers who watched the sky and who had a very profound understanding of human psychology and human spirituality. And my best shot at defining what they knew would be this. They knew that the human species has a particular set of potentials, evolutionary potentials, to learn, to adapt, to create, to imagine. And they intentionally introduced these images of the zodiac as icons to key us into those potentials, into our own spiritual potentials. That would be my best shot for defining how the zodiac was set up.
It does seem that there was ancient interest in the potential of humankind, that we are not just another intelligent animal on this earth, or even in the universe for that matter. And it seems, especially with the complexity and the immensity of the zodiac and the information that seems to be plainly written there for anyone who wants to be schooled enough to read it, that they thought that the potential of mankind was unlimited, that we could actually, if we could tap into the higher purpose of life with these symbols as a key or as a guide or as an inspiration, our potential is absolutely unlimited.
Well, I'm sure they felt that. Because we are creatures of the cosmos, and the cosmos is infinite, so why shouldn't we be? But I would also add that it's my understanding that these ancient seers, whom I call the Telestai, the guardians of the divine intelligence,
mm-hmm.
Understood that the potential of humanity is specifically organized in certain learning skills, you know? For instance, we all have different learning skills. This is a common sense observation. For instance, some children show from an early age that they have musical talent. Others have artistic talent. Others are interested in nature. Others are more interested in machines. And these learning skills are quite specific to each individual. I find that it's very helpful to apply this concept of learning skills to the zodiac. For instance, I think you would agree that it's important for the human species to evolve and fulfill its potential. It's important for us to learn. We are a learning animal, right?
Yeah, and I think we're at our best when we're learning.
We're at our best when we're learning. And the really interesting thing about that is, I'll put it in the form of a question. Why do some people learn better and faster about certain things than others?
Well, I think it has to do with talent as opposed to training. You can train someone to play the piano.
Right.
And later in life, they can read music and play songs at Christmas parties and that. But when you listen to someone who's talented at playing the piano, then it brings tears to your eyes.
That's right. Well, you have really touched the keynote, in fact, to the whole message that I have tried to put in my book, Quest for the Zodiac. I use the word genius, which you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And by genius, I mean talent. I mean that each and every one of us individuals is talented in a particular way, which, if we knew what our talents were, we could carry them out and develop them to a genius level. Now, the question is, how do we know what our talents are? See, one of the things that I found very disappointing about my astrological work was that even after 25 years of doing sun sign astrology, psychological profiling and counseling, if you will, but not predicting, okay, I could not answer the single most urgent question that people had, which is, what is my innate gift? What is my deepest talent? That which I could consecrate my life to, and by that talent, I could achieve my highest level of human potential. And what I found was that in the star zodiac, we can find what our talents are, but in the sign zodiac, we cannot know that because it doesn't contain that information.
Now, that seems to be one of the most valuable discoveries that I could think of for the human race. I have occasion to speak to young people from time to time, and believe me, there's nothing more frustrating than to speak to a young person who has inside them energy and zeal and no guidance. They don't know what they want to do. They don't know what they're good at.
It's a great tragedy of youth, isn't it?
Yeah. I tell them, well, go to college. Well, I don't know what I want to study. Well, see, that's the beautiful thing. They will put you on a course of study, and you may stumble into what it is that you're really good at.
But you may not.
Yeah, you may not.
And you may end up being trained, as you use that word, in a way that is not compatible with your genuine talent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I ride roughshod on them oftentimes. But, I mean, you might end up to be an accountant or something when you're really meant to be a filmmaker.
That's right. That's right.
I'm an engineer by career and a scientist, and I can tell you I have met thousands of engineers, and I always ask them the same question once we get out of whatever meeting or whatever project we're working on. I ask them, well, what's your dream? And they say, what? And I say, well, look, I know you're in here making, you know, piston engines, or engine pistons, or you're making wheel bearings, but what do you really want to do? What do you really want to make? And every single one of them, to a person, has something else they really want to do other than what they're doing for a living. They have a talent, and they have not been able to develop it.
It's so common, and it, in certain ways, is very, very tragic.
just imagine what would happen to the human race if there was your information, your star child information out there for people to tap into, where they could, you know, utilize their, let's call it a birth moment, to sort of come up with a smaller list of things that they might have a propensity for, hidden talents that they don't even know they have yet. And if they would try them, all of a sudden maybe these things would come out because of the synchronicity of the time that they were born and the place that they were born.
You have really got it. I tell you, you have really got the message of my book. It is so exciting, and it is something that is yet to be done in terms of application. You know, as you know, I've laid out in the book what I believe the star zodiac is. I've described it. I've recovered the star zodiac. That's why I call the book Quest for the Zodiac, because mm-hmm. we think we have the zodiac, but we don't even know what it is. Once it's recovered, we stand on the threshold of a most exciting possibility. And that is that this star child cycle, as I called it, could be developed into a program for young people that would not tell them, it doesn't tell them in a predetermined way, you know, what they should become. But through the clues and inspirations and images that are in the star zodiac, it would give them the catalysts to discover their own innate genius. It would give them an edge that we do not ordinarily have in society, because society doesn't recognize the genius of the individual. What a different society we would be living in if young people had the opportunity to actually discover what is the best in them.
I think the very, well, it's hard to imagine what the effects would be, but on a short term, I could see peace coming about. And on the long term, I could see the use and utilization of the earth and its natural resources changing in vast ways, way different than they are right now. Because there's an innate satisfaction that comes about doing what you really love. You don't necessarily need to make billions of dollars of profit. And for some reason, a $400 million annual bonus doesn't become as attractive as doing what you really are good at.
It's so true. Doing what you really are good at, realizing your own genius, is the most exciting and entertaining thing in the world. And if young people could be helped to make the decisions that would take them in that direction by using this star zodiac as an educational device for them, an assistance to them, it's not laying down a predetermined path, it would be so wonderful. It would contribute. Would it contribute to peace? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because when you are passionately engaged in your own creative activities, all you think of is peace. All you want is peace.
Well, that music means that we are coming up on our first hour break. Our excellent guest is John Lash. We will be back in about 6 minutes. Earth Explorers, hang in there. Foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to ArkOfMillionsOfYears.com. Get your autographed copy today. now, also available in full audio version. You own an inkjet printer, right? I used to purchase my replacement inkjet cartridges at a national superstore that will remain unnamed. A few months ago, I replaced the color and black cartridges, and the cost was nearly $80. Well, no more. Now, I purchase all my inkjet cartridge and copier supplies from 123 Inkjet. Now, I pay less than $15 per cartridge, and I got free shipping. Plus, every time I buy, I have a chance at winning a brand new printer. How cool is that? All you have to do is click on the 123 Inkjet banner at X Squared Radio, and you get exactly the same savings. Excellent printer supplies at super savings at 123 Inkjet at X Squared Radio. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. You know we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service. So you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have the neatest gift for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio. One of the things we have learned here at X Squared Radio from our emails is that many listeners to this program are educators. Well, we have recently added a great affiliate for you. The Academic Superstore is the place where you can buy software, neat tools and gadgets, and even supplies such as calculators and iPod peripherals at huge discounts. The best things for the classroom and for the student are just a tax-free click away. All you have to do is click the Academic Superstore sign at X Squared Radio and start saving. You probably know Kevin Smith as one of the premier talk radio hosts in the world today. Well, now there is a new reason to know the name. His new book, Gods in the Garden. It's a shining light of truth in print that takes us back to the origins of mankind. Don't be afraid to find out who you really are and where you came from. The answer will open the windows of knowledge for you, so you can see everything for yourself. Visit his website at kevinsmithshow.com or purchase it at the online store at X Squared Radio today. And welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. This is where the past meets the future. If you are just now tuning in, our guest is the world-renowned John Lash, author of an awesome book called Quest for the Zodiac. We've been discussing it, and in this hour, we're going to explore the concept of destiny. And in our third hour, I'd love to hear as much as we can about his latest book, Not in His Image, but we'll do that at the very end of the third hour. If you want to call in, you can call in from anywhere on Earth. I think you can get us off planet, if you can get close enough to the satellite. 877-876-5227 is the number. That's 877-876-5227. And we will take your phone calls. If you are listening on the broadcast radio, remember this is the second of 3 hours. If you're not getting all 3 hours, make sure to send us the call letters of your local AM station and we'll do the rest. Well, in recent years, there has been a tremendous amount of research performed on the human genome. There is a mysterious packet of 223 genes we term junk DNA that some may think may be the actual breath of life that makes humans sentient. And there is talk of genetic memory being passed along from person to person. You ask a curious question in your book. How can any single person be a conscious instrument of this vast evolutional flow? I think what you're asking is whether a person can be aware of propensities inherited from the fact that there is a different heredity applied from the zodiac to each person. Is that accurate?
That is accurate, and it's music to my ears. As I said, this is the first time I've publicly been able to discuss this before a large number of people. I've spoken about it in a number of my talks. And this concept that we have a different inheritance is so important. And I strongly believe it may be one of the most important concepts for our survival and for the betterment of the human condition, in the future, to create a world, to have a world and a society that is worth living in and that reflects the higher spiritual values that we all embrace.
Mm-hmm.
It is so important to understand that we have two inheritances. You know, I talk a lot about genetics in my book. You have beautifully paraphrased my explanation. But if I might go a little bit deeper into it, I'd like to say this a little more. We're all fascinated by the subject of genetics, and of course it is very complex. We know that the human genome has something like 300 billion base pairs. It's a tremendously complex entity. And if you print out the human genome, it would fill, the four-letter combinations would fill a 16-volume edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica in fine print. Everyone kind of knows that today, and we're all kind of fascinated about this genome thing. But what I would like to emphasize is that the inheritance that we are familiar with is our family inheritance. You inherit traits from your parents, from your grandparents, and your DNA code is very unique. The DNA signature of every individual is quite unique. And as we know, it's used in criminology to solve crimes and so forth. And a small amount of the genome, which belongs to humanity, is encoded into our individual chromosomes. And in that encoding, you have your genetic identity, as it were, inherited from your family. If there are diseases, it's the color of your eyes and other kinds of traits.
Mm-hmm.
However, as we know, without going into all the details of it, only a very small portion of the genome is encoded in your chromosomes.
Right.
Something like 3 to 5%. The remaining 95% of the human genome is not encoded in your individual chromosome signature. So what I'm proposing in Quest for the Zodiac is that you have a second inheritance. That other 95% of the genome that you're carrying is not inert. It carries another inheritance. It carries an inheritance that comes to you, Brooks Agnew, or to me, John Lash, from the entire human species. Not from my blood-based parents, but from all of humanity. And I call this the genomic inheritance, or the endowment. So we can distinguish between your genetic inheritance, which is your specific family traits, and your genomic inheritance, which comes from humanity, from the human species.
Mm.
Now, if you could know what your genomic inheritance is, what are the outstanding traits of it, then you would know what your learning skills are and what your deepest evolutionary talents are. And this is what the Star Zodiac shows us.
I made a note in the margin of the book to call this species memories, and you said in your book, let me just see if I can quote this accurately, the evolutional assets displayed in the gene type do not come from the ego or even through it, like memories that cannot be forgotten because they are not ours in an exclusional sense. These resources belong to the species entire. We have them on loan to evaluate how we live and to discern how humanity lives through us must depend on comparing what the personal self does from its acquired resources with what it might do from its innate resources. Is this the essence of the gene type in a nutshell? Is this what we're talking
about?
This
is the essence in a nutshell. You probably picked the best sentence out of the entire book to describe it. We all have acquired traits and acquired abilities. You know, we can be a businessman, an engineer, a rock star, a singer, a musician. But do these acquired traits by which we earn a living and a place in society, do they really reflect the highest potential of humanity that we carry?
Right. I know people have talents to learn something best. We really need to have a talent for it.
That's right.
It's like we talked about training someone to play the piano and then listening to someone who's really talented play the piano or the violin or even the electric guitar. You know, just about anybody can play guitar at a campfire at the beach or in a party or whatever. But to see somebody that's really talented, that can really bring out emotion in a six-string instrument to sway
mm-hmm.
25 or 30 or 100,000 people, just enthrall them with the sound from their fingers. That's talent. That is something that person had to have a propensity for from birth.
That's right. And one of the amazing things that I realized in working out this zodiacal code came to me through examining the charts of a great many talented people. In addition to the charts that I did for clients, which I did thousands of horoscopes over the years, I also spent a great deal of time on my own researching the charts of well-known individuals in all fields of life. Great scientists like Einstein, great philosophers, artists, dancers, musicians, writers, painters. And I was I was assisted in my approach by the concept of Abraham Maslow of peak experience.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, because there are certain human beings who have achieved a peak experience in some field of endeavor. And so I looked at, because I didn't know how to read the star code, I could see where all, for instance, if I would take, I have something right here, the horoscope of Rainer Maria Rilke, who was a very great poet. Or the horoscope of C.G. Jung. If you look at the horoscope of C.G. Jung and then you put the star zodiac behind it, you see where all of his planets are in the star zodiac,
and I could do this many years ago, but I didn't know what it meant. But I did know that Jung was known for having developed certain learning skills and certain talents to a very high degree. So I started to ask myself this question: was there any relationship between the patterns I find in the star zodiac and these extraordinary talents we see in certain individuals like Jung, or like a great dancer like Isadora Duncan, or a great poet like Rilke? And so it was extremely helpful for me to use the biographies of people who are highly talented in order to work out how the code works.
Sure, because there's a logical assumption that talented person has somehow synchronized their actions in their life with a talent that they were born with. And so aligning the stars with them is a good way of testing your theory.
Absolutely. I believe, that my theory is perfectly empirical. It's scientific, and it can be, if a large enough database were set up, it could be proven to be valid. We know that the genetic inheritance is provable. In other words, if you have green eyes and brown hair, we can show how that genetically comes from your family inheritance. Well, likewise, suppose that you were D.H. Lawrence and you grew up in England, you were born in England from a very poor mining family, your father was a miner, your mother was a not very intelligent person, and yet you have this tremendous talent for writing. Well, where did you inherit that from? Where did D.H. Lawrence inherit that from? He inherited his color of his eyes and his skin from his blood relatives, but he inherited his talent as a writer from humanity itself.
Hmm.
That's the genomic inheritance.
So what you're saying is that the spiritual quest today is aimed at recovering our lost faculties.
That's right.
So we have to activate our specialized learning assets.
Absolutely. We have to discover what our genius is, our innate assets for evolution, because the terrible problem that we're facing, and this is why the world is so crazy and why we're so far off the track, is because we have allowed human conditioning and culture to define the individual.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up Carl Jung. Carl Jung was a psychologist by trade. He wrote a great book called Man and His Symbols, which is a book I highly recommend you should check out of the library and read it. But as a psychologist, he treated Hermann Hesse, who was a great writer. And Hermann
mm-hmm.
Hesse wrote a book called Magister Ludi,
mm-hmm.
also another name it came out under called The Glass Bead Game. And mm-hmm. in that book, they do exactly what you're talking about. They
yes,
have
I know.
A school called Castalia, and literally every single discipline the child goes through, and of course the accomplishment is to receive these glass beads, which are a symbol of mastery of these things. But you have artists and sculptors and singers and musicians and engineers, and they're exposed to enough things that the thing that they're really talented at is able to show up, unlike a miner's son.
That's right. Magister Ludi is kind of a fictional prediction of what I'm talking about,
mm-hmm.
and what you're talking about. If we had a society where there was kind of where the educational system was more like a Castilian system, then children would not be educated, that is to say, they would not have education forced upon them. They would not be conditioned. The purpose of their education would be to bring out their genius. And I truly believe that if a large enough database was established, this system of the stellar zodiac could actually be used as a tool to do that, tool of guidance for young people to find their way in life.
Well, I recommend that after you read John Lash's book, Quest for the Zodiac, that you pick up Magister Ludi and read that, and then you'll understand what the term Castalian means.
You'll see that there's a very much a correspondence between what Hesse was talking about and what this book promises. By the way, I just want to say, because I don't want people to be frustrated, currently if you want to get that book, you have to go to amazon.co.uk. It's not available on Amazon.com in the United States. I'm making the arrangements for it to be so. I've sent them the ISBN number and so forth. So maybe within a month, I expect that Amazon.com will carry Quest for the Zodiac. But if you want to order it on the net and you go to Amazon.com, they'll say they don't have it. Just go to the UK version of Amazon.
Amazon.co.uk.
That's right, co.uk, and they will of course ship it to the States.
Can they get it at your website, metahistory.org?
Yes, the website that I write for the Marian Institute is called metahistory.org, and anyone out there listening who wants to contact me can write me at the website at my email address is metahistory@earthlink.net.
And we will provide a link for John Lash's book in our online store as well. So you can just come to X Squared Radio and get everything you need.
Well, so this idea of a genomic inheritance, Brooks, is just a tremendous thing. And,
it's a breakthrough.
It's such a breakthrough. And it's so important that there are ways to communicate it and to get this idea into the mainstream, get it into people's minds, because I think it's one of the best options we have for creating a more humane future here.
I couldn't agree more. In our last hour, we talked about how Earth was missing from modern astrology. Is there any evidence that Earth used to be in the zodiac?
No, it never was considered in the classical systems of astrology. And the reason for that is very strange. What I'm going to say now will sound very bizarre, but may sound very bizarre. But the Earth, according to the ancient seers of the mysteries in Europe, the Earth doesn't really belong to the solar system. It's merely captured in it.
Doesn't sound bizarre at all to me.
And so they did not include the Earth in the so-called, you know, model of the planetary spheres and things like that. For instance, when you go to Pythagoras, and you, who was an initiate in the ancient mysteries, and you see the system of the harmony of the spheres of Pythagoras, you find that the Earth is not systematically incorporated in the system in the same way as the other planets are. So
that's interesting. In our first book, we have a chapter in the Arc of Millions of Years. We have a chapter called The Union of the Polarity, and it kind of couples up with a chapter called The Arrival of Noah. And we talk about how the Earth is a captured planet in this solar system.
Is that so?
It was actually a free-floating planet and was captured by the Moon in this orbit.
I have to get your books, by the way. I haven't had the opportunity to read them yet, so I'll do so as soon as. This summer, I would enjoy having them, and then we can talk again, and I'll be
there's
more.
There's a lot of people in the UK that read them. We did a tour there last July.
Oh, really?
Went to England and Scotland and almost made it to Ireland, but I got hung up doing research at Roslyn Chapel for the second book. And because of that trip, we made a lot of contacts and have some people over there that are actually wholesaling books for us.
Oh, this is good. This is good.
It's quite available. We tried to get it for sale at Roslyn Chapel. They have a small bookstore there. I don't
know
if we were successful or not, but it's a very hungry society for this kind of information.
Yeah, there's a lot of interest in England. It's a special place in certain ways in terms of all the crop circles that show up there and so forth.
Well, I know that in ancient alchemical lore, especially Freemasonry, it's loaded with astrological terms and theories. How did the ancients view the Earth in their studies and beliefs relative to astrology?
Well, that kind of touches on the subject of my new book, which is coming out in September, Not in His Image. A great part of the book is dedicated to describing the mysteries, the pagan mysteries of Europe. And the central myth of those mysteries was based on the figure of Sophia, the goddess Sophia.
and she is actually the embodiment of the planet Earth. So the first thing we need to understand about the ancients is that they recognize that the Earth is a divine being, and that the intelligence of that being, the intelligence of Sophia, is actually what we are. We are not the supreme example of her intelligence. We are not the only example, because all animals and all sentient life is. But we are a kind of special case of the intelligence of the Earth itself.
Wow. So the human personality is the sum of all these influences?
The human personality is more or less of a social construct. The sum of the focus of the intelligence of the Earth is not your personality, it's your genius.
Ah.
That's where I make a very strong distinction.
Well, one of the things that also seems missing to me, since we're talking about gravitational influences on the birth of humans, is the other 94% of our universe. You admit that living on Earth, we are sunk into it as if plunged into an invisible continuum that is both solid and permeable at the same time. We know the planets and stars are perturbed by it. How does dark matter affect humans?
Well, that's a wonderful question. I wonder what dark matter is. There's a lot of controversy even among astrophysicists about the nature of dark matter. And I'm inclined to think that, again, the ancient seers, the ones that I've studied most closely have been the seers of the Gnostic and pagan mysteries, had some particular ideas about that. But they didn't speak of dark matter. They spoke of dark light or Osirian light.
I've heard it called that.
Yeah. Dark light is an interesting concept. And I think that they were very secretive about that, because the nature of dark light and the way that it affects us and its role in the cosmos seems to have been one of the deepest secrets of the ancient mysteries.
Well, it does seem so strange that the matter that we can see, i.e. the stars and planets
right.
and things, is really, 5 or 6% of the mass of
It's a pinpoint, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just a pinpoint in this unfathomable mystery of this matrix substance, which is dark mass according to modern physics, or dark light, black light, according to the ancient initiates.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also have a term, dark energy, which is sort of an oxymoron. We think of energy as at least some kind of vibration, some kind of frequency. And when we,
right.
There is light, of course, that we can see with our eyes, and then there's light that vibrates at much higher frequencies than that, and light that vibrates at much lower frequencies than that. But when we talk about dark light or dark energy, dark matter, it's not as though it's a parallel universe or another dimension, because certainly the gravitational effects are noticed in our third dimensional universe.
They seem to be. According to the ancients, it's the matrix. It's the matrix of all the 10 dimensions of space-time. I might add, as while we're talking about this subject, that it is also obviously a kind of touchy subject, because the word dark may scare certain people. As someone who spent a great deal of time in the dark, I can tell you that there's nothing scary about it at all. What's scary is ignorance. But
yeah.
Darkness is not scary.
It's funny.
Darkness is beautiful.
Yes. It's funny that you mentioned that. I have friends in the astronomy club. We have dark sky events where we drive out to some farm or up on the Blue Ridge Parkway. And, of course, the rules are for the club, when you approach, you turn your headlights off and go to
right.
park lights so that you don't, slam everybody's pupils shut. But the interesting thing is, all my friends, I know by voice. I've never actually seen their faces. So it's kind of interesting when we go to a restaurant or a party or we're at a convention or something, they'll wait for someone to speak before saying, oh, hi, Dr. Agnew, how are you? They don't recognize me by face.
Well, isn't that interesting, the way being in the darkness shifts your attention to the acoustic level.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so we're using, let's see if we can get back to this this zodiacal memory that we have, this inheritance, because I think it's remarkable and revolutionary, and if we can, you know, use this, the rest of this hour, to try to make this point, I think people will really understand it. It can certainly help us, you know, detect our exceptional talents and what you call our high-end assets.
That's right, our high-end assets.
But it's common knowledge that, you know, like you said, we inherit traits from our parents, like hair color, body shape, or even some of the talents that we have. Kids of musical families are often musical, and maybe
they
not
can
just
be.
Because
they can be, yeah.
Yeah, it's not just because they hear music being played all the time, but and sometimes it doesn't transfer. You know, look at John Lennon and Julian Lennon. It's just one is talent and the other is training, maybe.
That's right.
But if there's this astrological propensity, this more, I'm going to call it human synchronicity. I don't even know how to really term it, because here's the way I'm thinking about it. At any given moment, let's say in the next 30 seconds, there will be a certain number of babies born on the earth. According to astrology, they should have basically the same set of propensities based on the alignment of Earth with certain star constellations at this exact moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any research that shows that people born on the same day in the same year, and unrelated, have similar characteristics?
Well, there's very little research on this. I point to a couple of instances in my book. This is an area where a lot of research needs to be done. But in raising that question, I would like to clarify something. I state in Quest for the Zodiac that with the star zodiac, it doesn't matter where you were born on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
All people who are born on the same day have the same endowment.
Ah.
Yeah. That means that someone who is born on the same day and year as you has the same evolutionary endowment as you. They have the same optimal learning skills. But those optimal learning skills are inserted into a different genetic instrument, because you also come with a certain genetic talents that come out of your family inheritance, you
mm-hmm.
know. So let's say that there are 150 children born at one particular moment, and they all have the same evolutional learning assets. Those assets are going to be coming through those children in different ways, slightly different ways, because all the children are different genetically speaking, but the same set of assets is involved. Now, what we're talking about there is assets and learning talents. We're not talking about personal characteristics.
Oh, right, exactly.
Yeah.
But take it one step further and say, this is a cyclic thing. In other words, this exact moment will come around next year at this
That's right.
exact time. However, are we sure, I guess we're not, are we, that planets are not going to be in the same alignment next year?
Oh, they won't be.
At
they
this
won't be.
Time as they are now. So this moment is absolutely unique for the set of zodiacal inheritances that these young spirits will have, right?
That's correct. I would offer the word recycling. There is a constant recycling of these high-end human potentials. And each year, on your birthday, the planets are different positions. The sun is in the same position in the zodiac, but the other planets form a different configuration with the sun. So that means that the dice have been jumbled, and that the asset changes and evolves, and it's a constant recycling. This explains how children can be born who have exceptional learning abilities and exceptional talents that cannot be traced to their family inheritance.
That I have seen. That I believe is true.
Mm-hmm.
unknown to the listener audience, I have four children. Three of them are born in June, early June. I am born in the latter part of May, so we are all Geminis. And it's interesting, the spectrum of talents that my kids have are sort of a sampling of what I have. Not just genetic, but I mean the...
Stellar.
Yeah,
because the configurations in the star zodiac are the same.
And our ability to communicate, not just verbally,
is
highly enhanced compared to, you know, families that may have conflicting signs in the same family. They can't figure each other out or get along at all. But we, it doesn't matter where we are on Earth, almost know what the other person's experiencing and know how to advise and help that person.
Well, this is a good occasion to demonstrate to listeners the difference between a sign zodiac and a star zodiac.
Yeah, let's
You're born at the end of May. What day, actually?
27th.
Yeah. You're born the 27th of May, which is in the sign of Gemini. I don't deny that. So you are going to have Gemini personality traits. Fine, no problem. But as I've said, personality is not the end of human evolution. Personality is only a social construct. If we want to understand the talents and the elements of your genius, which does not belong to you, but is an inheritance from humanity, then we have to look at where you are in the constellations. And on the 28th of May, the sun was found pretty much in the center or the face of the constellation of the bull. Now, this doesn't mean that you're not really a Gemini and you're a Taurus, because that's a mistake. And I, as you know, I try to correct that mistake in my book. When I speak, and this is extremely important for people to understand, when I speak about a second zodiac, I'm not talking about a different set of personality types. The star zodiac is not about personality types at all. It's about these innate talents that we've been talking about. So what I would say is that you and your children are Geminis, your Geminian personality types, and you will exhibit predictably those traits. Beyond that...
That means we have a caller on the line.
Oh, good.
Caller, can you give us your first name and where you're calling from?
I'm Sherry, and I'm calling from Ohio.
Oh, welcome.
Doctor,
question for our guest?
Yes, Dr. Agnew and John Lesh. I just wrote an email to Don about 10 minutes ago because of the show. And as I listened to you talk, I just was compelled to call in.
I'm glad
you
did.
So I'd like to read the short email and then ask a question. I run a research facility in Ohio, and I also have a show on BBS. I think that we've decoded some of these individual genetic codes that John is calling genetic or genomic inheritance. We call it electromagnetic genetics, and we can provide some information for each person in less than 5 minutes if they'll give us their birthday, and the information comes out in a report form in terms of their health. We do vocal prints, but we don't need one to do this part of it. But if we have the prints, we can see the challenges for that individual at the moment. Because what you're talking about, genetics, what we found is the code actually contains 16 layers. And it depends on what you eat, who you're around, your thought process, anything that would affect what you want to call your signature sound. For instance, if you'll give me one of your birthdays, I can show you if you're interested. If not, just the question of maybe we can answer part of this for people about why somebody born on the same day has different issues.
Well, this is fascinating. It sounds to me very much like you have another piece of the same information here. I'm sure there are other ways of accessing this stellar code information, and that there are compatible systems. Sounds fascinating. Sounds also highly quite sophisticated, what you have.
16 layers would lend itself to a lot of probabilities.
That's right.
A lot of algorithms to write.
Right.
Well, we have.
Well, there are actually 16 components to the stellar zodiac.
Well, I need to get your book. It sounds totally fascinating.
Well, I think those of us, I think it sounds like we're working on the same track. You know, the priority I sense, and talking with Brooks is really bringing this to the forefront, is that this is something for the future and something for young people. It's a tool of guidance, and you know, our world is very polluted, very confused. There's a lot of toxic stuff out there. There's a lot of bad parenting. There's a lot of bad social programming. And how are the young people going to find their way through that to their divine inheritance, you know? Anything, any tool, any system that contributes to that is of immense importance today.
Well, I'll get you an email. If you'll give me your birthday later, then I'll just run you through the system and you can see how it works.
Let's do that. You can write me at metahistory@earthlink.net, and I'll give you that
information. Say it again. I've got somebody rattling in the background here. What's the email again?
Metahistory, like metaphysics, metahistory,
okay.
@earthlink.net.
Great. I'll do
Thank
that.
Thank you very much.
Bye now.
Thank you so much.
So if I could just jump back to you for a minute, I was saying you and your children are of the Geminian psychological profile, astrological profile, but what could I say just as a piece of your endowment, because we have to look at where all the planets are,
mm-hmm.
but what could I say just as an initial clue? What does it mean to have a stellar endowment from the bull? Well, for one thing, this indicates a deep innate talent for ritual, a deep attraction to beauty and to the expression of beauty in dance and movement and ritualistic forms. It also indicates an ability for, highly evolved ability for sacred geometry and for understanding and sensing the fractal patterns of the cosmos, for understanding the music, the divine music that infills matter. It indicates a visionary ability to see the divine shaping forces of matter, which are represented by fractal patterns and by the divine proportion, sacred geometry.
So I guess becoming a physicist was a talent.
Was a certain expression of that. Exactly.
Yeah.
We could say that you may have been attracted to becoming a physicist because of that. You know, the Pleiades are in the constellation of the bull.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you that the first time I looked at the Pleiades through a 25-inch mirror...
You got a jolt.
Oh, my goodness. I climbed,
Who doesn't?
I climbed
Who
up
doesn't?
Ladder, and
yeah.
I looked through the eyepiece, and I saw color and a depth, and oh, my goodness. So
when you see the
light.
Depth of them, it's astonishing, isn't it?
It doesn't... You cannot see that with the naked eye. There's just no way. And this, of course, I was lucky to be in a very good astronomy club. We had a 25-inch mirror, a Dobsonian scope, which was just perfect for looking at stars. And we swung that thing around and put it on there. And oh my goodness, it was like looking at you know, through the Hubble or something. There was so much to look. I just looked for an hour solid at the top of that ladder. I was enthralled with it.
There's a lot out there. There's a lot to see. Also, one other thing I might add is that the bull, constellation of the bull, now again, I'm not talking about the sign Taurus, that's a
mm-hmm.
different
mm-hmm.
model, represents a repository of assets. I think this is becoming clear now. Each of these constellations is a repository of assets that human beings have evolved over many millennia. And every time that a child is born, a new generation is born, they pick up a certain set of those assets to be redeveloped. And so if you know what your assets are, you know what you're carrying for humanity. It's not for yourself. It's what humanity is trying to bring through you and trying to carry forward and to refine. Another one of the assets of the bull is an interest in music and in psychoacoustics, in the properties of sound. And so there is a scientific element in the bull in regarding the fact that there's an interest in the structure of mathematics and the structure of matter. But the real, the key thing I would emphasize here, Brooks, is that it has much to do with aesthetics. That is to say, I would say that you became an engineer as much in order to appreciate the aesthetics of the universe as to appreciate the physics of it.
Yeah, I think you've got it. It's not that I wanted to build machines or understand
processes. Or dam up rivers and things like that.
Yeah, it's that I wanted to understand how things work.
How they can be as beautiful as they are.
Yeah.
And how the form and the function are so united in the beauty of the form.
I know a lot of engineers, and I belong to several societies, and we trade best practices as often as we can. But I'm always amazed at how we can go into a new facility as a group just to make observations, and they will come away with different observations than I do. It's not that they're right or wrong. It's that somehow I can see the leanest, most beautiful way to make what it is they make. It's natural to me.
Well, that would be a talent I would definitely associate with the bull, constellation of the bull.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, like biological twins having very similar traits, star-based twins will also have similar traits.
That's right, they will.
How about that?
And the way that they discover and develop those traits, of course, it depends upon their environment and their parenting and their upbringing. We're all tremendously vulnerable.
Well, sure.
You know, I didn't have a hell of a lot of support or recognition when I was a child that led me in the direction of my genius and my evolutionary assets. I had rather, you know, expectations placed upon me and things expected of me that were not necessarily compatible with my innate abilities. And I think that in that sense, I was probably not exceptional. I think that many young people have that same, may face that same challenge.
Well, again, I think many do. And I'm amazed at the quality of the young people that we have coming to the Earth now. I don't know if it's alignment of planets and stars and the plethora of talents with which they're endowed, but I can see greater potential in the generation that's coming through school now than say when I went to school. There were a few, you know, really bright people, talented people, but now it seems like it's hard to find one that isn't talented. But as you say, unlike you and unlike most people, I had none of that support. I had no parents to support me. I was sort of handed from one relative to another until I was able to get out on my own. So everything that I have, I scratched, I learned, I adapted. You know, I worked three jobs at one time, whatever it took to support my family and get them where they are. I don't have any family whatsoever to fall back on, nor did I receive any help through school. I paid for everything myself. And I'm sure there are a lot of people out there like that. But that taught me something, too.
Yeah.
That taught me that I work for myself. That taught me that I have to be self-reliant if I'm going to be successful. There is no one that I can rely on except for myself. And so that also influenced how effective, and that's a key word, how effective I was with what I was doing. And I have to say, I'm competitive with myself. I am constantly trying to do better. I constantly try to bring a better sound and a better program with X Squared Radio. How I got into talk radio, I really have no idea. I'm a scientist primarily, but it seems that this medium has matched me pretty well, and I'm having the time of my life with it. And for some reason, X Squared Radio is growing. People like to listen to it. So I'm going to keep doing it because I love it.
Well, there is a hunger out there for some voice of sanity and some signs of sanity in the massive insanity that we call human society, isn't there?
Yes, and hopefully either the live program, which I know there are a few people that listen to it, but the archives people, I don't know, about 12 to 14 million people a week cruise those archives.
Is that so?
And hopefully somebody listens to this and says, I have to get John Lash's book because I need to understand this concept, but hopefully they also they see that they've got a couple sets of inheritances, not just what they were handed from their parents and their genetic propensities, but a humanity set of propensities that they need to find out about and they need to try to develop.
You know, I don't want to sound, you know, arrogant or grandiose because this is something that I have discovered and worked on, and it seems like, you know, it's coming from me, but it's much, much bigger than me. I mean, I really think this is such a liberating idea, and that so many people will be relieved and inspired when they realize that we have this other inheritance. I know for myself, it has been a great, great influence in my life and a great source of strength for me to know that. You know, to know that the best you have in you is something that has been given to you through the love and learning and joy and suffering of millions of people that you don't even know, and that they have left a kind of deposit, and that is a, I call it, as you know, a transfer, that the experiences of learning and delight and discovery that human beings have made through the centuries have been transferred to you, that you have a precious share in that, and that you can carry it forward on your own terms. I mean, to me, that has been one of the most wonderful insights of my life.
I'm just running in my mind some probabilities of this. We have just been thinking about one generation, but now you've opened sort of this endless generational inheritance that in my actual genetic line, there may have been many who found their talent and developed it and grew it and passed it along. You know, our genetics are made certainly of our parents, but also their parents and their parents.
That's right.
And so on and so forth. And if you go back through the family tree, and I've got my genealogy pretty firmly on my father's side done back to the year 695.
Oh, really?
It's not a huge family line. We were subject to death because we were involved in war, because we were the nobles that sort of protected the common people. But also because we were landowners, and in the European medieval times, having a lot of children meant dividing up your lands into smaller and smaller pieces. So most of the large landowners had very few children in order to keep their inheritances large.
Uh-huh.
And so if you look up the name Agnew in most phone books, maybe, even in the big cities, there might only be three or four. As opposed to, say, maybe Smith, even though the name goes all the way back to the 3rd century. I just haven't done my genealogy back that far. But I've stood in front of the tombstones of my ancestors all the way back to the year 1339.
Is that so?
And, you know, I know how many kids they had, and I know when they died and how they died, and that's good information to have. But it's not just their genetics that I inherit. It's also this zodiacal inheritance that I inherit.
That's right. And there's one way to illustrate that. This is part of the program that I envision along the lines of a Magister Luti, you could say. If the system that I'm proposing in Quest for the Zodiac were to be applied, this is one of the ways that it would work. A 16-year-old would sit down in front of a computer, and they would put in their birth date and year, and then they would be able to select from a series of categories of sort of what they are interested in. And let's say that it's a young girl of 16, and she's kind of interested in, well, geography, dancing, and maybe she likes poetry. So we put in these categories. And then the program would go and search in the database of famous people and artists and writers, and would come up with a series of names of, say, for instance, if she's interested in dancing, of well-known dancers who have similar endowment as she has.
Ah.
A matching. It's a matching system. And so that would lead the person, they would go on a quest, and that would lead them to, for instance, perhaps this girl would discover then that she had similar elements in her star zodiac, could be compared to Isadora Duncan, who was a fantastic dancer, basically invented modern dance at the beginning of the 20th century. So the program would show her visually that she has Venus in the constellation of the goatfish, and so did Isadora Duncan. It would draw these simple matches. Then she could go and she could find out about Isadora Duncan. She could learn about a human being who had a similar endowment to hers. And in that way, she could come to own and understand her own endowment. So there's a real factor of providing role models, creative role models, through this system, which I think would be really interesting to see what that would do for...
That's a marvelous idea.
Yeah. Because I don't know about you, Brooks, but that's certainly the way that I have found my path in life. You know, I didn't have particularly good role models in my family, and my parental situation was not good at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I found my role models in writers and artists, and that I read about their lives, and that inspired me to discover my own talents. And I think that that's a very good way for young people to nurture themselves.
Well, I think it's more than a logical assumption that the alignment of someone's great success, and I mean, let's take for instance, I played baseball when I was in high school. I was
mm-hmm.
I was talented at it, and I
mm-hmm.
I went to a farm team, and I was on a track to be a professional baseball player.
Mm-hmm.
But I looked at the other players, and I noticed that on their scale, and we're talking about talented ball players, not really trained ball players. On that scale, I was average. Even
mm-hmm.
though I was exceptional in high school, I was average in this group.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had great aspirations to go to college, which I had no money to do. And at that time, I think pro baseball players were making about $16,000 a year. So at least at that
not
level.
$16 million. Like
yeah, exactly. I think I would change my mind today, but I decided to go in the Air Force instead and get the GI Bill, and that was instrumental in helping me get my bachelor's degree, which
mm-hmm.
launched my career.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I made the right decision. But that being said, if a young person had the opportunity to assess their desires, or at least look at their birth sign and say, okay, you should have the propensity to be these things,
mm-hmm.
and then pull up famous people. So you have
mm-hmm.
you have now aligned talent with opportunity and become the best of the best, like these pro baseball players.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'll tell you, when the baseball was expanded, you saw a lowering in the standard of the game.
That's right.
Because the best were not in there.
That's
in,
right.
In order to make up the teams, you had to bring in second best. And
mm-hmm.
that changed the game.
Sure.
These people really had a talent for baseball, and they had the opportunity to play baseball. It made
sure.
a huge difference. So I see exactly what you're saying, and I know we're coming to the end of our second hour, and I hear the music. So we will take our second break, and then we will come back, and I want to get more into this concept of the endowment, because I think this is key to what we're talking about. I'm Brooks Agnew, and this is X Squared Radio, and we'll be right back. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Did you know that 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts? It's true.
soon men and women will be doing the real moonwalk. But just so we don't forget, the first footprint on the moon has been replicated in a limited edition plaque that would make the perfect gift for a court of honor. Maybe you need something special for your office or your library at home. This high-quality plaque can add that something special that lets people know how excited you are we are returning to the moon. Visit Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio today and order your limited edition First Step on the Moon plaque. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They've come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio.
You know, thus is the place where the past meets the future. If you have done your genealogy and found that you have roots in the Irish or Scottish clans, then don't you think it would be a great idea to have a replica of your family crest? You can get a coat of arms, a ring, or even a family tartan that may help you or your grandchildren remember your ancestors. This is the time when the hearts of the children are turned to the hearts of the fathers. We only carry the best. So if you're ready to experience the glory of your past, you're ready to visit Scottish Heirlooms at X Squared Radio.
People are always looking for something inexpensive and unique. Give people they love. Well, now there is a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it also allows you to help keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers at X Squared Radio is the company that will plant a tree on public land somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that place. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world. And because of their love for the Earth, they are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person. The space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. If you know someone who loves the space program and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the Space Store at X Squared Radio. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. If you like wildlife art and would love to add some of the most beautiful replicas to your home or office, you should visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas to fish to eagles to horses in all sizes and price ranges. No matter what animal you love, they have the art for you. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for that special someone today. Come on, 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 come on Welcome back to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Our most excellent guest tonight is John Lash, author of The Quest. Quest for the Zodiac. I'm sorry, I was looking at something else. Our phone number tonight, if you want to call in from anywhere on Earth, 877-876-5227. 877-876-5227. We have been reviewing this book, and I'm fascinated by it. I'm fascinated by the guest and his insights. I highly recommend the book. It's a great read, extreme amount of detail, great drawings and charts and things inside of it. If you ever thought you understood astrology, you probably don't, because you haven't read this book. You need to read it to get the rest of the detail. Also, this is our third hour. For those of you in the AM world, if your station is not carrying all 3 hours of X Squared Radio, be sure to send us their call letters, and we will take care of the rest. Many religions and traditions talk about humans being endowed with certain rights, privileges, or even keys to things in life. Most people, even if they know about the endowment, ignore it. You say in your book, the consequence of this act is immense and life-threatening. For this ensemble of specialized learning skills carries the quintessence of our fabled sapience, our tribal wisdom, what you like to call premium. What is premium?
Well, this is a term that I use. As you know, there are certain neologisms in the book. When you're attempting to formulate a new idea, you need sometimes to play around with language. And I used the terms endowment and premium to try to express this concept that we each have in us a portion of the best that humanity has realized in its previous experience. And if we can identify what that best is, that unique learning potential, then we can claim it, and we can evolve it and carry it forward. And this seems to be the way that humanity, this seems to be an expression of our unique talent as a species to learn and to grow and to advance. Today, we desperately need these star children, as I call them, the human beings who are realizing their own genius and who can carry forward this unique potential of the human race.
Mm-hmm.
To return to the analogy I mentioned earlier, the entire genome, if you print out the entire genome in all its letters, it's about 6 billion base pairs. So it would fill about 16 volumes of 500 pages each. That's 8,000 pages of the genomic code. Now, the amount of that code that goes into your genetic makeup is only about 400 pages.
Really? And that's quite a bit different, 400 compared to 100 billion.
400 pages out of 8,000 pages. I'm comparing it to a book.
I see.
So the question is, what about the rest of the 7,600 pages of the genetic code? Is that just irrelevant? Is it junk DNA? They use that strange phrase.
Yeah.
How could anything that produces life be junk, right?
Well, that's what I say. I mean,
yeah.
I'm
saying is that you not only have the endowment of your chromosomes, but you have this premium that you've inherited from humanity, and that is found, that is a selection given to you out of the other 7,600 pages of the genome.
Well, I know there's been much talk of freedom lately, and we sort of bandy the word about in various ways and in various political rhetoric sometimes. I ask young people who are trying to rebel against all that is good and decent, because they say they want to be free, I ask them, is it a freedom from sin or freedom to sin that you seek so fiercely?
You say that we are not free unconditionally, but we are free to choose. Do you think that we're only truly free when we are choosing?
I think that the issue of freedom can be very perplexing and so confusing that at a certain point you might just not want to think about it anymore. But I suspect that there is a way to think about it, a different way. I suspect that the whole issue of freedom may be misstated. I'll tell you just from my personal experience, when I feel that I am the most free, it's very, very clear to me. I am the most free when I know and feel and sense that there is something greater than myself coming through me.
Yeah.
That's when I'm free. In other words, freedom is a paradox and can be a trap, because as much as I try to be free, i.e., I'm going to have life on my own terms and do what I want, I get caught in the trap of my own terms. In a sense, I can never be free on my own terms. It's a trap,
yeah.
And that's a trap that many young people fall into. Rebellion just leads into a trap, whereas the real road to freedom is to let something larger than you come through you.
Well,
that's real freedom.
I sometimes ask them, well, you know, what would you like to do for fun? And of course, everything that they want to do is very expensive.
Yeah, right.
And so I ask them, well, you know, I would like to do that too and have some of those things I've done, but how do you propose to pay for them? Oh, I'm going to have a very good paying job. Well, you know, let's work ourselves backwards to where we are at this point in rebellion. You want to drop out of high school because you want to be free. And yet what you are choosing is the absence of choice. I kind of liken it to, and if you just humor me just for a moment, I kind of liken it to a long hallway with doors on both sides.
Yes.
You start out life and all the doors are open. You can
right.
walk down the hall, you can go into any door that you like. But as you commit transgressions against others and against yourself and against humanity, these doors close off. And before too long, if you become wicked enough, all the doors are closed and it's just simply a long hallway. All your choices have been removed.
Right.
And I tried to explain that the idea in life is to live so that you keep all the doors open at all times.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that you can go back and go into doors that you passed up, but I am saying that you have the choice to be anything you want to be. And what is fascinating about your book and your concept, and I think it's just absolutely revolutionary, is that you have figured out a way for young people, and even people younger than me, to find the doors of the right color so that you're not looking at a billion doors, some of which would have no interest to you and yield you no specific optimum life. But you would be able to narrow it down to doors to which you naturally have a propensity. You have an inheritance for it. And I think that optimizes your freedom, does it not?
Absolutely, it does. I couldn't put it any better than that. You have to deselect from all the possibilities of life that set of possibilities that mirrors your innermost potential, or your divine potential, if you want to call it that. And I do really think there is an element of divinity in it.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly it is a creative potential. And you have said it so beautifully. Freedom is not about blowing all the doors off. It's about finding the doors that have the matching colors to what you have.
And there are many, I'm sure.
And there are many. It's very versatile. I think that anyone who reads my book will understand that the learning program I'm proposing and the guidance program I'm proposing with the Star Zodiac is not at all rigid. It's extremely flexible, because we are, at best, extremely flexible animals. We are the most adaptive of all mammals. And so your endowment, which is this transfer of skill that you acquire from humanity, is not going to be rigid. It's going to have various facets of it. We are all multi-talented. Genius is a multifaceted experience, and that's something also that Hesse understood very, very well, and he represents it in Magister Ludi and also in some of his other works.
Well, I like your choice of words. I think most people would like to be associated with genius, but what I find people that haven't made a choice. They just go along asleep, like zombies through life.
Well, I think it's helpful to point out, Brooks, that there is a great challenge that comes with this breakthrough into the star zodiac and into the deep potential of the species. And the great challenge is that I think it's a challenge that humanity doesn't face all the time. I think there are some periods of human evolution, some periods of civilization when this is not an issue as much as it is today. But
yes, I think we're in a critical period.
We're in a critical period, and one of the ways that I describe that in the Metahistory site and also in this book is I say that we're all facing a choice. It's not nice to say this, and it's not pleasant, but we're facing a choice between committing to society or committing to the species. And if you're committed to society and you just want to succeed and get along and do something so that you have all the perks and rewards, the chances are that you're not going to realize your human potential on that path. Society has become so perverted and so toxic in many of its elements that the individual who chooses to adapt to society today will probably be making a choice that totally removes them from their innate potential. That's a very frightening thing to say, but I feel that has to be put out in the open and said very frankly.
I think you're absolutely right. I heard it said once that millionaires do not make their investments based on the zodiac. Billionaires do.
That's an interesting statement.
Well, in your book, you mentioned a couple of very successful ventures. One was 2001, A Space Odyssey, and the other one was put out a mere 7 years later, Star Wars.
Right.
And both times, the producers, Stanley Kubrick and George Lucas, used the Zodiac, or at least influences of it, to figure out the timing of when to release their movies.
They did indeed. And also George Lucas used the advice and guidance of a great mythologist who spoke of these matters, and that was Joseph Campbell.
How about that?
Yeah, Joseph Campbell was a personal advisor to George Lucas on Star Wars, and he gave him the plot.
Well, all I know, I went to see the movie, it was out about 3 weeks, and I had, at that time, I owned a 1967 Barracuda with a 383 in it, and I drove it from Provo to Salt Lake, which is about 44 miles, and I went to see the movie by myself. And I went to the 7 o'clock show, so the line wasn't really very long. And I went in and sat down, and literally, from the opening credits to the closing credits, I was absolutely blown away. Never seen anything in science fiction like it. But here's the real the key to the story, is the drive home. When I got back into my 383 Barracuda on the freeway, I was an X-Wing fighter. That movie was tremendous, and of course I've probably seen it about 35 times since then, and I have the remastered one as well. I've seen all the episodes multiple times. I'm a hopeless sci-fi freak as well. And I don't know...
Well, it's mythology. Science fiction is a very powerful form of mythology, and mythology is the great key to our species. These zodiacal constellations are all about myth. They are repositories of myth. And I've said many, many times that it's myth that guides the species, you know, one way or the other. It's myths that that engages the collective imagination. Consider what we're facing today with this 2012 thing. I mean, here's a myth, the myth of the end time, the myth of the end of the world. And we're all trying, or many of us are trying to get our minds around that myth so that we can make the best possible opportunity out of that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, well, my co-author and I spent a couple of years researching that on top of our first book, and the second one is entitled 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times. So, you know, all these things kind of fit together, and it's amazing how the focus, at least at our level, seems to come back around to the subject over and over again.
It will more and more so, I believe, too. I do believe that is the subject coming up the road.
I think so. It's like I've been saying a couple of times tonight, it's sort of the synchronizing of the human experience with the predicted events that are getting ready to come about. And I was going to ask the question, I think we've already answered it. Do we have specific gifts prepared for us long in advance by unknown ancestors?
Absolutely. You know, to just take the example again of D.H. Lawrence, because he happens to be someone that I know and love, and also because in my endowment I have certain matches with Lawrence. But D.H. Lawrence had a fantastic talent as a writer, and he inherited it from somewhere. Everything we have, we inherit. But he didn't inherit it from his blood parents. So that leaves open the possibility that those talents had been prepared and developed for him by other people, other human beings. They were deposited in the genome. And then when the throw of the dice came around and D.H. Lawrence was born, that specific set of assets burst out of the genome and was ripe and ready to be redeveloped.
Ah, I see now how that fits together.
Yeah.
And of course, he had the opportunity to receive some training in that, and he instantly took to it.
Well, he had the opportunity. He was lucky in that, like we were saying before, and this is important to emphasize it again without being repetitive, many young people, many teenagers are not compassionately and rightly guided toward their true potential. But Lawrence had the instinct to follow that true potential and to develop it, and he did have some clues. Usually, if you look in a person's life, there's someone will show up. It may not be a member of the family who is helpful in as a kind of a wise old man or wise old woman figure in pointing you toward your innate talent. But the situation today, Brooks, is one in which society has gone so far off the rails that if we do not find a way, as we're coming up to the end time, to tap into this talent and to recognize it and to get back to our innate evolutionary genius, we could go into a really strange spin in evolutional terms. And that's why I think this coming moment is very relevant to the whole process we're discussing here this evening.
Well, I have long thought that mankind is on the verge of some kind of metamorphosis, that you know, certainly there is evil in the world, but there's also a great wonder and great creative forces going in the world right now, and the fact that we can transfer information so quickly and so perfectly across, you know, vast distances. You're in Belgium tonight talking to me in Western Kentucky with my producer in Paradise, California, and we're bouncing this right back to Australia, you know, all live at the same time. This is an amazing time.
Yeah.
And people with talent that are exposed to the thing that they're talented at are going to rise to the top immediately.
That's right.
And so this is kind of like we have, of course, bonding with our earth parents and grandparents and great-grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins, but we have a bonding with our forebears, don't we?
That's right.
Through this.
In my new book, I call it the species self-connection. We each have a bond between ourselves as an individual and the human species, a bond with humanity itself.
Well, how do we access the genius for ourselves? Are we going to have to know somebody that's read your book, or somebody that's familiar with the presence of this inheritance in the universe? And we're going to have to do it at a fairly young age, too.
Well, it's a big question you raise there. I don't have a pre-formulated answer for this, as I hope to have communicated so far in our conversation, which has been absolutely splendid, by the way, brilliant conversation, that it's a process of discovery, and that the innate talents and innate genius, say, of a teenager, is something that they will find in various ways. I think that, however, I would highlight two elements. It is important to have mirroring. Sometimes the mirroring we need will not come from family, from parents and role players of that kind, but can be found through other people we admire. As I said, great athletes, dancers, artists, philosophers, explorers, and so forth. So the mirroring is important to bring us into the endowment. How do we access it? Well, that's the big question, That's the big question, and that's something that I'm working on. And I wouldn't want to give a premature answer, but I'll tell you something. That relates in a very interesting way to my ideas about the 2012 threshold. You see, I see the 2012 threshold not as a moment that we reach, as if it were a destination. We're all on this train now, right? And we know the train is heading for 2012, December 2012, and bang, when we get to then, that moment, the train stops and we all get off. I don't see it that way at all.
I don't either, but go ahead.
I see that we are on a train, and that when the train reaches December 2012, we enter a time window, and that we're given a certain amount of time, which can be calculated, I believe, for humanity. Let's just say roughly 50 years. We enter a 50-year period. It's the beginning of a very important period for humanity, in that during that period, we should be answering the question you just asked. We should be concentrating on how to access this endowment of the species and therefore produce a course correction for the species. I don't believe, and you probably don't either, and we haven't had a chance to talk about this, and I'd love to read your book and then talk with you further, but I don't believe that there is going to be an automatic collective course correction for humanity when we hit December 2012. I believe that that's just the moment when the work of that correction really kicks into gear.
Sort of like the beginning of a new renaissance for the human race.
That's right. And the renaissance, if you go back and look in history, the renaissance did not happen as a collective or quantum leap in the consciousness of humanity.
No,
the renaissance
didn't.
Happened because certain people catalyzed it. Certain people made it happen. And so those people now need to prepare for that moment, because it's always a catalytic group of people who bring about a collective change in the human psyche.
And I might add, in the time of the Renaissance, it was extremely difficult to propagate information. So catalyzing that society was much, much more difficult than it is now. You know, something we are very aware of here at X Squared Radio is the destiny of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
It's written in countless books. It's carved into mountains all over the world. It's and paid for with the blood of generations. It seems to all lead us to a time known as the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the term come from, and what does it mean?
Well, it's an old Greek word. It means the opening of the seals. Apocalypton. Calypton is a seal. And you can interpret that in many ways. I think consistent with the conversation that we're having, perhaps you could say this. the opening of the seals could mean the accessing of the deep divine evolutionary potential of our species.
Exactly the way I think of it as well.
Is that so?
Yes. That
well, I'm all the more eager to get your book so I can take a big bite out of this in your language and see how you've developed that.
I understand the prophets. I've read the books, and
mm-hmm.
I've meditated on the prophecies. But I also see what's happening to people, and I see that that there is a way for a collective awakening, or at least a more broad scale awakening than we've ever had before. Even the year that I was born, when Albert Einstein passed away. This was a period of time when a handful of geniuses had the opportunity to change the world, and they did. Now, we're reaping the results of that. I was going to say benefits, but I actually don't think nuclear awareness is a benefit to the world, personally.
We've had some wonderful results, and we've had some very terrible side effects.
Well, of that there's no doubt, but...
Right.
But the fact that there are talented people out there who can get exposed to their niche, to their genius, to their premium, instantaneously now in our society, and the fact that we have a medium that great works like yours can come out and be exposed to millions of people in a single evening all over the world, these are the kinds of events that open seals. And what I mean by seals, I mean like a bottle cap. You're actually letting out the effervescence of a capped up talent that's
mm-hmm.
in a collective somewhere out there in our society
mm-hmm.
that will save us.
Mm-hmm.
They
that
have
will provide
the
possibility to correct our evolutionary path.
Yes. They
put
have
us on the right evolutionary path.
They've got the secret to endless energy. They've got the secret to the cure to cancer. You know, they've got the ability. They just need to be shown that they have the talent and be given the information. And they can do much more with it than those who are simply trained in it.
So you would say then that this approaching this 2012 threshold, as I call it, would be a time of enormous activity. A time of activism of a very extraordinary kind.
Well, I'm not doubting the prediction of cataclysms, but
earth changes.
Yeah, but yeah. I am saying that if people will listen and move out of their and move out of the way, they can actually survive those cataclysms. I think we have a caller on the line. Can you give us your first name and where you're calling from?
Anne from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Okay.
Two questions. As it relates to this, I tuned in late, unfortunately, so if you covered this, I apologize. You call it the star zodiac?
Yes.
As it relates to that, can you explain, I guess, the origin or etiology behind these traits and talents you're referring to? Where does this, I mean, I realize you're talking, you know, it comes from the stars, but can you expound on what exactly that means, coming from the stars, what's behind that?
That's a good question.
Sure. And you have a second question?
Yes, which is completely unrelated.
Well, give it to us now and we'll come around to it.
Okay. The second question is it possible, or I guess maybe probable or likely, that, as in my case, I can relate to the both of you, in that the biological parents didn't do a lot to encourage my current talents.
Right.
Welcome to the club.
It's an understatement. And I have always felt, as a small child growing up, that even though I know I'm biologically theirs, I never really felt like I was a part of the family.
Switched at the hospital.
Pardon me?
You were switched at the hospital.
Well, I honestly, I felt like even beyond that, I mean, I just simply felt like these, you know, I didn't belong there, that there was something, I belonged to something greater. I just didn't know what it was. Always felt that way, even when I was 5, 6 years old.
And so does your question concern that sense of belonging or something?
I guess, is it just conceivable that you, that the this non-biological relationship is superseded, the feeling is superseded by this genome or greater than sort of relationship? Does that make sense?
Sure. Well, let me take the first question first. I want to say that it would be foolish for anybody to think that we can totally rationally reduce or explain, you know, in a Cartesian sense, this zodiacal code. I've gone a long way to decoding it and showing how it works. It's important to understand how it works and to experience it and experiment with it, but not to believe that we can ultimately understand it, because it ultimately belongs to some, I'm convinced anyway, that it ultimately belongs to some fantastic mystery of the cosmos and the way this whole game we call life has been set up. So I just like to kind of insert that as a disclaimer. Nevertheless, I will try to give you my best explanation very briefly. It's simply a matter of mirroring, you see. It's not a matter of cause and effect. We've been talking here for the last few hours about the fact that you are a genius. You have something in you of genius that comes from humanity. It is an endowment. It is a premium. It is a select set of learning skills. Now, that is in you because it is in the human genome. It's not in the stars. The stars is simply a code that has been devised by some fantastic wizards, I don't know who they were, to reflect it back to us and to show us how to trace that inheritance. So there is, your destiny is not in the stars, it's right here on Earth. Your human potential is not in the stars, it's right here in your genetics. But the fantastic thing is that the pattern of that potential is reflected in the cosmic pattern. That is like an awesome wonder of the world that we live in, and no one will ever be able to explain it down to the final letter. But the fantastic thing is that we can experience it, that we can use it, that you can learn to read that code, and through the star zodiac, you can come to understand what your innate potential is.
Because it appears that the birth moment of a person has a record in the stars.
It's a transfer.
Right.
I use the technical term phylogenetic transfer. At that moment, the heavens record what part of humanity's high-end assets are being transferred to you.
Ah, very good. That's perfectly said.
Sure.
Yeah. Now, to get to the second part of your question, I have a lot of feeling about that, and I have a lot of compassion for you and all the people who feel alienated as you do. And the only thing that I can say is that we do not belong to our parents. We belong to the earth. We belong to the goddess of fire. We belong to Gaia. We are children of Gaia. And it is through that connection with the divine intelligence of the earth that we realize who we really are as human beings. So, of course, it's wonderful if we have good parents and if we have love and nurturing in our parental situation. But unfortunately, I believe that is not the case for most children who come into the world today.
Mm-hmm.
But there is an option by our bonding to humanity and our bonding to the planet. This is the same bonding. And that is the bonding that's going to ensure a future for our species.
That answer your question, Ann?
It does. I just want to throw one thing out at you on that. and maybe this is something that's a completely different tangent, but as it relates to what you just said, there is a field of thought that suggests that part of us anyways comes from somewhere else, meaning another part of the universe.
Sure.
I agree with that.
Oh, I do too. In fact, in my new book, and I would like to say a little about my new book, if I might, I see that we're down to kind of the last 15 minutes here, and I would feel remiss if I didn't speak of it a little bit, because my
publisher...
As
would I. Go ahead.
Yeah. My new book, which is called Not in His Image, is coming out it'll be in the stores in September, I think, and you can find out about it by going to metahistory.org, the website. In any case, one of the things I do in this book is I recover and redevelop some of the ancient teachings from the Gnostic and pagan mysteries of Europe. And those teachings were embodied in a certain story, a sacred story of the goddess called Sophia. The word Sophia in Greek means wisdom. And it was the name of the goddess who is embodied in the earth. And she was the central figure in this sacred story. And I tell the story in the course of the book. I take this, by the way, from the Gnostic writings, the Nag Hammadi Gospels. The sacred story is found in those writings, but no scholar has so far attempted to retell the story, to reconstruct it and retell it. Now, to get around to this idea of where we come from, perhaps you've heard of the word panspermia, which is this concept.
What was that word?
Panspermia. Panspermia is a scientific concept that was introduced by a Nobel scientist around 1905, which suggests that life on Earth was seeded here from somewhere else in the universe.
Right.
That's called panspermia. Well, the ancient Gnostic myth of Sophia, which I reconstruct in my book, describes panspermia, and it explains, the myth tells us that the human genome was actually implanted in the atmosphere of the Earth from a cosmic source. So the Gnostic myth of the Sophia is a very clear statement that we do indeed come from somewhere else in the cosmos. But it does not mean that we are alien to this planet. We were created in order to be here on this planet. And the creation of the human genome and the creation of the Earth are intimately related. And that is explained in the sacred myth that I'm discussing in my new book.
Great.
Well, that sounds fascinating, too. I'm going to have to get a copy of that and have you back on the program to talk about it.
It would be wonderful. I would love to come back and talk to you about that particular thing. I've had the opportunity in my life, a great privilege actually, to have worked in depth with these the Nag Hammadi Library. I'm sure you're aware of what that is.
Yeah, I've read it.
And many of your readers will be also aware. And by what some people might call a peculiar coincidence, I was actually born in the week and the year when that Nag Hammadi Library was discovered.
1947?
December 1945.
45.
Yeah. It was discovered in the first week of December 1945, which is actually when I was born. And the significance of the Gnostic documents at Nag Hammadi in Egypt were not realized until 1947. There was a delay of about 18 months before they fell into the hands of a scholar who recognized what he was looking at.
And then it took, 40 more years till they figure out how to open them and read them?
It didn't take too long. They put a team on it immediately. And the problem is, and I explain this in my book, that so far, no scholars writing about the Nag Hammadi materials have actually explained to the public what the true message in those materials is.
Oh, that's true. I mean, even the English translation is quite fragmented.
Oh, it's deplorable.
Yeah.
It's gibberish. I have total compassion for anybody who tries to read the Nag Hammadi Library in English, you know, which is the standard translation. You go completely out of your mind.
Yeah.
But not only is that a problem, there's a lot of problems with this material because it's written in Coptic, which is a very difficult and kind of phony language. But the real problem is that the scholars who have been responsible for presenting the Nag Hammadi material to the mainstream, such as Elaine Pagels and Marvin Meyer and other scholars,
mm-hmm.
are coming from a Judeo-Christian background.
I found that too. I found that exactly.
And their only interest in the Nag Hammadi materials is how they reflect on the origins of Christianity.
Yeah. Does it support their point of view or does it not?
That's right.
And I didn't want to leave you hanging, Anne. I wanted to make sure that you had both your questions answered.
Yes, I did. And I quite frankly didn't want to interrupt or just, you know, hang up on you. But I want to thank you for your comprehensive explanation, really.
I hope it's helpful, and thank you for calling in.
Thank you very, very much. It's an honor speaking with you both. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, our pleasure.
So just to get back to this point for a minute, it's an absolute scandal, and I have to say this, and I'm very, this is the first time I've said this publicly, but it's an absolute scandal what has been done with this Nag Hammadi Gnostic material.
I've got it, I actually have it electronically, and I've been able to do word searches and things on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty familiar with Sophia and
mm-hmm.
the epochs and the time period.
The eons and the archons and so forth.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And some of that makes sense, and I look at the way the Gnostics put it together, and they sort of had to put it in code because their lives were being threatened. They had withdrawn to the wilderness and lived their lives the way they wanted to, their way. And when it seemed like their society was threatened to extinction by war, they rolled up their writings and hid them in clay jars in caves in the Nag Hammadi area. And I think we lost a lot of them to treasure hunters.
Well, we lost a lot of them. You know, the Gnostic writings were not only hidden in jars and in caves, but the Gnostic writings were widely available in antiquity for hundreds of years in many of the great libraries connected to the sacred temples of Europe and the Near East. The Library of Alexandria, for instance, was packed with Gnostic writings, packed. They were not secret. They were very much available to the public. But we lost all that. It was destroyed with the rise of Christianity.
Sure. And the same thing happened to the Mayans. They had libraries full of books recorded on gold plates. And
that's right.
When Cortez and
that's
his,
right.
Church-funded organizations arrived, they didn't see the value of the writing. They saw the value of the gold and promptly melted it all down.
That's right. But there was also an imperative because they were carrying the message of salvationism and the Christian doctrine to the world. There was an imperative to destroy these pagan and heretical teachings.
I'm sure they were saved.
So what I've done in my new book is that I have presented for the first time the Gnostic message from the Gnostic viewpoint.
Oh, that's
from
great.
The viewpoint of the Gnostics themselves.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, just sort of recapping our program tonight,
mm-hmm.
we were talking about a global awareness that is sort of coming alive in people through the zodiacal memories that we are nearing this time of the opening of the seals. I think people that I interview all over the world, I ask them pretty much the same set of questions. I ask them, do you think we're at the end of days? And to a person, they say, oh, yes, I believe that. And I ask them, what do you think is going to happen? And, of course, I get everything from, oh, we're going to be hit by an asteroid and killed, or there's going to be a big gravitational wave come out of the center of the galaxy. We talk about all kinds of cataclysms, but the key thing is that everyone, educated or not, has this feeling that something is about to happen. And they don't really know how to explain the feeling either.
But it's an intense feeling and it's very widespread.
It is an intense feeling. And they're changing the way they live their lives based on this feeling.
Well, that's
that
the key thing,
having.
Isn't it? That's really the key thing. I mean, to me, the feeling reflects the realization by many people that our way of life is unsustainable. The way of Western civilization, of materialism, of consumption, is unsustainable.
I think in your words, what needs to happen is this endowment is fully present from the first moments of our lives.
That's right.
And then you claim that immediately begins to expire. So what can we do to prevent it from extinguishing like the last flickering candle in a deep cave?
Well, I think we're coming to a great crossroads with this 2012 threshold. I think that it will be more and more, there is forming now a group of people who will have to be, as it were, warriors or champions for the human spirit, and will have to stand for the human spirit and for this divine potential against the insanity of the social world that we've created. And I see that happening, and I hate to present a polarization and make it seem polarized, but it is in a way polarized.
It is polarized.
But it can be a positive polarization.
Sure.
Because the champions of the divine potential are not going to attack or go negative against society, but they are going to try to take society through the membrane into another incarnation.
Mm, well said. I like that. I like that, and I also like the fact that that we won't go negative. We'll stay positive.
No, not at all.
And that's what this show's all about. That's why it's called X Squared Radio, because any number times itself is positive. So the results in here are always positive.
Having talked to you for 3 hours steady, I feel like I understand what X Squared means. It's really gone to my head by now.
In here, we also slow down time, so 3 hours does not seem like 3 hours in the real world. It actually goes by in about 25 minutes.
That's right.
I think it's the fastest 3 hours in radio, because it just doesn't seem like we've been talking for 3 hours, but we've covered so much.
We have. It's been tremendous, and I do look forward to perhaps talking with you again when the book is out and people have had a chance to look at it.
Sure. Well, I was going to ask you one final question. This Zodiac, I mean, it actually records all the events and stores them for the future.
That's right.
Do you think we can access this future before it is time for them to actually happen?
Well, I think that the people who are, there's an old cliche where someone said, geniuses are not ahead of their time. It's just that most people are behind their time.
Oh, that's well said, too.
Yeah. I think that the individuals who can access their own genius, either using this zodiacal code or however they may do it, are really already working from the future. They're already in the future. And they constitute a kind of strange attractor on the other side of the 2012 threshold already.
I like the way you put it. You said that there's three stages of this awareness. First, sensing a mission but not knowing what it is.
Right.
Second, formulating the mission in a personal vision, and that's really important. I think people have
very
to
important
to that. And the third is putting the endowment into action.
Yes. And to the extent that we're doing that, people who are doing that like you, we're already working from the other side of time. We're already working from the future into the present.
That's correct. Oh, I like the way you put that. You know, I teach my kids sometimes. They say, Dad, you know, I don't want to go through this exam, or I don't want to do this this job. And I tell them, well, you know, what helps me get through things I really don't want to do is I put myself out into the future, 3 or 4 hours or 3 or 4 days, and I look back at that event that I was doing, and I say, yeah, that wasn't so bad. Or I made a mistake. I needed to redo it this way or say it this way. And once I have that realization in the future, I just come back to the past and go through
mm-hmm.
it. And it's pretty simple then.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can move around in time, and maybe dancing around in time is what it's all about.
Well, I think it is. We've got to, as a human race, figure out how to do that. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the program. My guest has been John Lash. His great book is Quest for the Zodiac. It's available at amazon.co.uk. Very soon it will be available at amazon.com. But if you want to get the book, we will put the link in our online store at X Squared Radio, so you can click on that, and it'll take you to amazon.co.uk for you. And that way you'll have two ways of getting to it. And, of course, the archive of this show will be available as soon as I get it mixed down. And it will be available for podcasting as well. Do you have any, if you had one more thought to add to this program, what would it be?
Courage and delight. Those are the two things that get us through everything. So I wish that to all who are on this trip.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I appreciate you being on the program tonight. And
well, thank you so much. It's really been wonderful.
3 o'clock in the morning in Belgium, so I'll let you get a few hours sleep before the sun comes up.
I think I'll go out and look at the stars. How about that?
Oh, sounds good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, I appreciate you Earth Explorers being with us tonight, and I will play our exit. It is about, looks to be about 85 degrees in western Kentucky, and a very peaceful evening. I greatly appreciate you being here, and I appreciate the phone calls, Ann and Sherry from Ohio, and you can call that any time, and don't forget to access the archives. It has been our pleasure to have you here this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we try to provide the best 3 hours of talk radio on Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours where you live, send the call letters of your local radio station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, who you are. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe. So try to do it on purpose. Be aware that every life is immensely valuable. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.